From deep in the Swedish forest, the only individualist radio program in Europe, this is BSI Radio International. Underlying most arguments against the free market is a lack of belief in freedom. Questioning all belief but acting upon conviction, this is the voice of the sovereign individual. My name is Paul Lambert. Long-time listeners to VSI may recall my discussion of the so-called anti-concept. Essentially, an anti-concept is a rationally unusable term. Typically, it involves obliterating one valid concept by packaging it together with an invalid concept. More specifically, with regard to tonight's discussion, the anti-concept I have in mind is one that confuses some forms of honest and legitimate behavior by packaging it together with dishonest behavior. That anti-concept is the one entailed in the notion of a so-called black market. Any form of trading that goes on outside the confines or in contravention of the law is said to be on the black market. What makes this such a viciously deceptive package deal is that there are activities that are in contravention of the law which are perfectly peaceful and honest and which involve the free will and consent of all those involved, while other illegal activities involve the initiation of the use of force or fraud against an unwilling party and are inherently illegal. The term black market can encompass both kinds of activities. Think of all the various laws we have prohibiting many different types of behaviors, and consider those behaviors themselves, and ask yourself why you think they're prohibited. Is any given activity wrong in and of itself? Or is it simply against the law? This question is often presented using the Latin phrases malum in se, meaning that it is wrong in and of itself, versus malum prohibitum, often expressed in the plural mala prohibita, meaning that it's wrong due to it being against the law. It is a simple test, if applied correctly. Essentially, remove the element of the law. Say two people are on a desert island far beyond the reaches of the law. Would a given behavior be wrong in such an environment, even in the absence of the law? For instance, consider the act of one man on the desert island, without any provocation, taking a club and hitting the other man on the head. Is that wrong to do, even when there is no law to prohibit or punish that act? On the other hand, say that both men came from a place where gambling is illegal, but in the absence of the law, they spend their time there on the island playing cards, perhaps betting coconuts or seashells. Is that wrong in itself? Now, there are, broadly speaking, two general trains of thought when it comes to the philosophy of law. One is that of the positivist view, which holds that all law originates from society, and even questions of right or wrong are determined by whatever mechanisms the given society has in place. Positivists generally have a problem with the distinction between malum in se and malum prohibita. In a positivist legal thought, which forms much of the basis of modern civil law in Europe, all law is based on legislation, and crime as such is defined simply as such acts that are prohibited by law. The other broad school of thought is that of natural law. Natural law is the traditional basis of Anglo-Saxon common law, which is based largely on legal precedent and on certain philosophical principles. Under natural law, it's often held that the rights of man are God-given and not subject to the whims of society. Within the secular realm, this simply means that there are certain objective universal truths, and the law must stem from them. It's man's task to discover such truths and to formulate his laws accordingly. Now, you might disapprove of gambling as such and find it wrong to engage in such activity. However, that's not quite enough for it to qualify as malum in se, or wrong in itself, in a legal sense, or in the moral code from which such a law comes. In order to discover the salient difference between whether a given action is wrong in itself or merely against the law, it is necessary to take a look at all the parties involved in a given activity and to see whether or not each of them consented to the given transactions. Thus, it's easy to see that approaching another man totally unprovoked and clubbing him in the head is wrong in itself, as that other man did not consent and the initiation of force was used against him. Whereas if two men decide to engage in a game of cards and play for coconuts, it's not wrong in itself, or malum in se, as both parties agreed to this activity. To those who consent, no injustice is done. Coming back to civilization, the lesson is still pretty simple. If a group of men want to sit around a table and play poker in a back room, provided that all those involved are there on their own free will, the behavior is not wrong in itself. Yet, in many parts of the world, such an activity is illegal, and the fact that nobody was forced to take part who did not want to is not an excuse or even a mitigating circumstance in the eyes of the law. This is mala prohibita, or wrong, because it's forbidden. Using consent as the litmus test, it's easy to see how stealing is wrong, as it involves the use of force or fraud against another person, and thus wrong whether or not the law can, will, or is inclined to do anything about it. Many thieves steal in order to sell the stolen goods to another party. Of course, such trading in ill-gotten goods is also wrong and is illegal. But of course it goes on, and one can say that there is a black market for stolen goods. In the overall equation, somebody has had his property taken from him without his consent. However, consider the man who, instead of becoming a thief, decides to earn a living by doing work for others who are willing to pay him for it. Prior to the introduction of income tax, if a man went out to dig a ditch for a farmer, and then that farmer gave the man cash in payment at the end of the day, that was considered doing an honest day's work. As soon as income tax was introduced, that very same activity, an activity involving no coercion, and with the consent of both parties involved, suddenly became prohibited. Given that untaxed work for cash is cheaper and less of a hassle for both parties involved than is taxed work paid by check, it was natural that a market would emerge in all fields of commerce for off-the-books work. Such a market is also referred to as a black market. We have one blanket label to apply to two greatly different activities, the first dishonest, the second honest. The first, wrong in itself, the second, simply made illegal, in spite of the consent of both parties involved. Well, where's the body? Who's the victim? That, too, is an old principle in the common law, in which for a crime to have been committed, someone must have been made a victim. The state itself could not arbitrarily insert itself into a transaction and then claim to be a party. This was even more apparent in the ancient Roman Republic, where, even in criminal court cases, the state would not prosecute a suspected criminal, but rather the victim himself had to file and present the case himself. Or in the case that the victim was dead, some other party could act as the accuser. And indeed, there were professional accusers who were hired by victims or their families to press their cases in a way that a state prosecutor might do today. Poor victims who cannot afford the services of a professional accuser needed not to despair, as it was very common for such professional accusers to do pro bono work, as it provided an opportunity to gain prestige by representing more and more victims in court, and still more prestige was gained by winning convictions. However, nowadays, with regard to income tax, the state has decided that it is a party to all monetary transactions, and even go so far as to hold that those who do not pay income taxes are stealing from the government. What a reversal of logic. What legitimate claim does the state have on your earnings? How does the state justify income tax to itself beyond It's the law, i.e., we're a bigger gang than you and we want your money and we'll take it by force. And levying income tax solely in an amount proportional to your earnings and having no relation to any expenses the state might have spent on you, the government is initiating the use of force against you. The state takes something that belongs to you without your consent. There's no escaping this. People often tell me that they don't consider taxation to be stealing, but they never tell me why in any satisfactory way. The only way in such expropriation, an expropriation whose rates are solely at the discretion of the state, could not be stealing, is if working people are the property of the state. Or if the state has a 100% stake in everyone else's labor. Well, I beg your pardon, but I don't recall ever issuing shares of stock in the fruits of my labors. One common question I get with regard to income tax is, how would the state raise the money it needs without income tax? Well, there are answers. Indeed, the state raised money before the introduction of income tax, but really that question is improper. This is a classical logical fallacy, namely that if one finds the necessary consequences of an argument to be inconvenient, that does not mean that the original argument is false. That the state would find it difficult to raise funds without taxing incomes does not mean that taxing incomes is not stealing. The question is furthermore improper in that it assumes that I need to provide an answer as how otherwise to raise money, basically to do the state's thinking for it, when in fact, even if I cannot come up with a way for the state to raise money without taxing incomes is still stealing. It's not about me. What kind of deranged argument is that, anyway? Think of a way for me to raise money or else I'll keep robbing you? Who else would get away with that? Imagine a career house burglar who knows no other life and is finally caught. After serving a sentence, he is then told that he needs to make an honest living, but he complains, how do I earn a living without robbing houses? And then he tells us that he will continue to rob houses unless we can think of another job suited to him. Do the people of his community owe him some free career counseling in exchange for a promise that he not rob people? And then, would it be unfair of the people in that community to lock their doors in order to keep from being robbed? How is a house robber supposed to make a living? So, for the state to say that people who do not pay income tax are stealing from the government are essentially saying that people who lock the doors to the houses are stealing from the house burglars. If we had not become so used to the institution of income tax over so many years, its twisted logic and moral decrepitude would be abundantly clear.
Thank you. you just let it ring a little longer, longer, longer? Oh, I'll just sit tight in shadows of the night. Let it ring forevermore.
One of my favorite programs on WBCQ, one of them, there are plenty that I really like, is Ramsey's Roadhouse, Monday nights at 7, which I encourage you to listen to as well. Ramsey has a very down-to-earth way about him, and he skillfully strikes a balance between the lighthearted and the serious in everything he says. At the end of each episode, he gives a salute to the working man who keeps the country going and who raises his children and pays his fair share of taxes. Now, as to paying the fair share of taxes, in spite of everything I just said before the break, I actually agree with that sentiment as such, although Ramsey and I might have different views as to what that would entail in practice. In fact, I'm certain we'd have different views on that. Well, does that sound a bit confusing? Well, the problem is found in the very word tax, or taxation, in that it's rather an anti-concept as well, or at least it's become that. There are indeed times when it is right and legitimate for the state to collect money from people, and at other times that it's not. But by placing both instances under the blanket category of, quote, taxation, the difference is obliterated, and this fact gives intellectual ammunition to supporters of taxation in arguing against intellectually disarmed adversaries. Consider this example, which demonstrates a gross twist in logic that you will not miss. Well, let's see. Well, how should I put this? All right, let's see. Say I go to buy a hamburger for which I'm willing to pay. Indeed, I won't get the hamburger without paying for it. So, say I drive up to the restaurant in a car. While having my hamburger inside, some thief breaks into my car and steals the radio. Maybe he really needs that radio. His favorite show is on tonight and the electronics store is closed. How else is he supposed to listen without stealing the radio? Naturally, upon finding my radio missing, I'm very upset and feel victimized. Now, stay with me for a moment. A proponent of income tax, using the same logic behind the arguments they make for taxation, might look at that situation and then conclude that I'm not willing to pay for my hamburger. Have I lost you? Well, good, because that is the crazy logic behind one accusation often made by proponents of income tax. And it takes advantage of the anti-concept in how it blurs salient distinctions. I'll explain. If you tell someone that you're against taxing people's incomes, you'll often be asked, don't you think you should pay for what you use? My answer is, absolutely I should. And the problem is that taxation in general involves both paying for what you use and purely redistributive programs, i.e. organized theft. Certainly, I should pay or repay any money the government spends on my behalf, one way or the other. I find it perfectly sane, moral, and even practical and convenient that the Swedish Ministry of Transport, the authority that builds and maintains roads and bridges, is funded through revenues raised by point taxes on fuel. Each time you fill up at the pump, you pay for the roads you'll be using. No filings involved. Your privacy is not invaded. No matter how much you earn that year, you pay simply for your use of the road. It's also very efficient in terms of bureaucracy, as the tax is collected and remitted by the petrol station during its normal course of business. There's a certain proportionality to it as well, as those with larger vehicles, which cause more wear and tear to the roads, typically also require more fuel per distance traveled, and thus drivers indirectly contribute more to the upkeep of the roads relative to the wear they cause. Now, it might be argued that those few who own power lawnmowers, but not cars, are unfairly paying for roads that others use, and furthermore that bicyclists get free use of the roads. But given that is the case now, I find it to be a picky complaint, with one of the very few arrangements in this country that I otherwise find to be ideal. Now, on to the other side of the anti-concept. Taxation is also the means by which the state robs Peter to pay Paul, or redistributes wealth from those who have to those who do not have it. And perhaps that's not 100% accurate either, since many people who already have lots of money still get some more from others, who might even have less. So I should put it this way. Redistributive taxation takes money from those who have earned it to give it to those who have not. There are indirectly redistributive programs, such as socialized medicine and public education, into which all are forced to pay, regardless of our use of such systems, but under which we nevertheless are covered should we at any time need to avail ourselves of them. What are even more egregious, then, are the directly redistributive programs, such that forcibly take our money and give to others with nothing at all in return. Such things include allowances for mothers of newborns, who get benefits regardless of their financial situations, and child benefits paid regularly to parents of all children under 18. Even the King of Sweden collected child benefits for his children. There is, of course, the dole, or the social welfare, in which the state takes your money to give to non-productive people simply for being alive. There are sick leave benefits, old age pensions, unemployment benefits, and other such programs that are dishonestly referred to as insurance plans, when in fact they're nothing of the sort. Then there are grants to the arts, housing subsidies, food subsidies, educational subsidies, and foreign aid, to name just a few. In fact, on my 2012 income tax forms, one page had a breakdown of all things on which my tax was spent. 43% of it was on such purely redistributive programs, which does not include education and healthcare, which ate up the vast bulk of the rest. So clearly, under the tax system we have, which is so staunchly defended by the proponents of income tax, this is a country in which lots of people do not pay for what they use. Of course, that was by design. Remember, too, that the vast array of social programs are rationalized on the basis that if people had to pay for what they used, there might be people who could not afford them, and thus user pay as a concept is not fair, so they say. Notice also that those of us who do earn a living and then who complain about income tax are told that we need to pay for what we use, but those living off the system and consuming more than they produce are never told that. In fact, we're all told that such people are entitled to a whole host of material benefits as a right, regardless of their ability to pay. So the question, "Don't you think you should pay for what you use?" is disingenuous to the extreme. Equally disingenuous is the claim that those of us opposed to such taxation have the ballot box as a recourse, while proponents of taxation know perfectly well that isn't true. There's not a single party on the ballot that will abolish income tax, and even if there were, the proponents of tax know that they would never be elected, since the number of people mooching off the system is growing, and that they will continue to vote to feed off the productive. When five wolves and one sheep get to vote on what to have for dinner, we know who's going to get eaten. Is there any surprise that more and more productive people are working off the books, getting paid cash under the table and selling their labor on the black market? Now, I'm not going to come onto the radio and encourage listeners to go out and break the law. I will say that I think that working off the books, on much the terms that a ditch digger prior to income tax legislation would have worked, is a perfectly honest and morally defensible action, and I can respect someone who refuses to pay income tax on principle. I just hope he doesn't get caught. Now, that said, there is a certain scumbag element out in the world of off-the-works book and the black market for labor generally. That's in the phenomenon of people who collect social welfare benefits, but then work off the books in order to continue to collect such benefits. I think such people are being paid twice for the work they do. About 10 years ago, when I worked at a pub in Gothenburg, I'd often encounter people looking for work as dishwashers and barbacks. I was glad to get them, as there was a high degree of turnover, and we were always looking for people to work in the back of the kitchen. But on occasion, I would meet someone who seemed promising, but then he'd ask if he could get paid under the table, since he was collecting social benefits, and he wanted them to continue. I would invariably tell him no, and then invariably refuse to hire him. On one occasion, I didn't even have to refuse the fellow, since he made it quite clear, since that he was on benefits, he was not interested in anything except off-the-books work. Now, some people have disagreed with my position that one should simply refuse any government benefits, and that the notion that we should try to get back some of the money that we've paid into the system, I find to be a rationalization. Having had our own houses robbed does not give us the right to rob someone else's house, but I know not everyone sees it that way. Though I'm not personally convinced, I do find there to be a compelling moral case for people trying to get back whatever money they've paid into the system, money that was taken from them without their consent, and that they should try to get it back, perhaps look at it as a form of restitution. So if you do collect things like unemployment insurance, old age pensions, or any other benefit to which the state thinks you're entitled, that's perfectly fine, given that you have also paid into the system according to the rules and have become a part of that system. On the other hand, someone who refuses to be taxed and works in the black market on principle must be principled enough to refrain from collecting any benefits extended to a system in which he had no part in contributing. Working off the books must be one element of an overall break with the system. It's typically not legal, so don't get caught unless you mean to get caught. Otherwise, I approve that wholeheartedly, and it turns out so do many more people than you might think. What would it take for you to go underground?
Swanee, how I love you, how I love you, my dear old Swanee. I'd give the world to be among the folks in D-I-X. I even know my mammy's waiting for me, praying for me down by the Swanee. The folks up north will see me no more.
Again, I'm not suggesting that anyone go underground and start working off the books. However, if you're already inclined to do so, there are a few things I think you should keep in mind. Firstly, I should point out that in most cases, and depending on which country you live in, as long as you have access to the offshore sector and such things as trusts, it's likely not necessary to resort to the black market. There are legal means to minimize or even eliminate one's tax burden, which are not nearly as awkward or complicated as many would have you believe. Beyond that, as I understand, it's not legal to give financial or legal advice without a license in the United States, the First Amendment notwithstanding. I'll leave it at that. I will add only that if you're thinking seriously about legal tax mitigation, I can only suggest that you consult a tax lawyer and see if he can set you up. Of course, if it's your intention of making a test case to bring to the courts and set a precedent, then you will quite openly and deliberately refuse to pay tax. You may believe you have a killer argument to bring before the judge. Perhaps you've found that income tax is unconstitutional in the United States, or that the 16th Amendment was never ratified. From the reading I've done on the subject, you're absolutely right, but what I also know is that, all principles and arguments aside, people who refuse to pay tax can and do go to jail. Bringing test cases in front of courts is heroic and is one of the few ways that laws ever are changed for the better. Just keep in mind that you run a terrible risk and you must be prepared for the court to find that you're wrong. If instead you just want to get on to living without having the state rip you off year by year for a sizable chunk of your income, it's probably best to stay out of trouble and just see what a good lawyer can do for you. I think that any business, big or small, running as a going concern, should be able to benefit greatly through the use of offshore trusts, but you'll have to find out for yourself. Many of you will be familiar with a book publisher called Paladin Press. I think that's how it's pronounced, Paladin. It's a book publisher based in Colorado that generally publishes nonfiction of a certain action theme. They write about military, survivalist topics, martial arts, guns, medicine, similar topics. Most of their books are in a kind of how-to format, be it how to build a log cabin retreat, how to build a submachine gun, how to break into a computer, how to break a man's neck, you know, that sort of stuff. I do have quite a number of Paladin Press titles, probably close to 24. To be frank, I've rather mixed reviews about their publications. Some are more useful than others. But even among the most useful ones, I generally find that by the time I finished reading one of their books, I had hoped to have found more information than I got. Some books are clearly written by authors who know what they're talking about and have real-world experience in what they're saying. Other books leave me with the impression that they were written by some hothead or else by some nerdy fellow permanently on the internet Googling every word that has to do with wilderness survival or guns, and then cutting and pasting all sorts of absurd articles together, or gathering wisdom from a chat forum, rather than any real field tests. Still, most of the books I have from Paladin Press form an interesting introduction into their respective topics, but it is almost always clear that a more serious study of the topic will require that one continue to look elsewhere. One of the better writers is Ragnar Benson, which is probably a pen name and may even be more than one writer. Whoever he really is, it's clear that he has at least some experience in the things about which he writes and that he offers good introductions into his topics. One such book was Ragnar's Guide to the Underground Economy, which is largely a book about earning a living off the books, and not about any inherently dishonest activities, nothing that would qualify as malum in se. Now, Benson starts off from the assumption that the reader is interested in going underground, as there's no mention of other legal means of tax mitigation. The decision has been made to go black in the minds of readers. There can be many reasons for going black. One of them is the sober reality that in today's economy, going black is often the only means of obtaining employment. There are entire fields of work that would not be done if they were all reported and taxed. Already, such people as cinema ushers are a thing of the past. Given minimum wage laws and the costs of taxes and social insurance fees, such a job cannot be economically justified itself. A lot of cleaning, yard work, construction, and jobs dealing with pets and animals are dominated by the black market, so much so that the tax authorities in Europe have had to extend special tax breaks in order to bring the people working in these fields into the mainstream market. At times, the black market is the only way in which to obtain certain products, and no, I don't just mean illicit drugs. Certain trade barriers and product legislation keep certain items, even very innocent ones, off a few markets. Even in a country like Canada, there is not the same variety of goods to buy as in the United States, as legislation in Canada requires all packages on goods sold in that country to be both in English and French, regardless of the market or region in the country it's to be sold. While this on the surface might simply seem to be a question of a little extra ink, many suppliers in the United States or other countries cannot justify the extra expense that entering onto the Canadian market would entail. And if the Canadian market is too small, consider a country like Iceland. Thankfully, Iceland does not have the same regulations concerning packaging, or else the store shelves would be bare. In fact, very few product packages on Icelandic shelves are written in Icelandic, for obvious reasons. However, when I lived there was a ban on a certain kind of food coloring that was used in M&M's candies, and thus that product was not legally available. Fortunately for me, I befriended a U.S. Navy sailor stationed at the NATO base in Keflavik, who would bring me and some other friends all sorts of goodies from the base, including M&Ms and Oreo cookies and all sorts of great stuff. Being the young hotheads we were, some of us thought we'd make a big demonstration by sitting on the steps of the Icelandic parliament eating our packs of M&Ms. Of course, nobody cared. As we discussed, the black market is also one outlet for those opposed to income tax on principle. However, there's another reason that I find somewhat dubious. There are people who refuse to pay tax since they don't like the way tax money is spent, thus leaving me to assume that if it were spent in a manner more to their liking, they wouldn't think it's so bad. There are a few problems with that. Firstly, of course you're not going to like the way tax money is spent. That's the whole point. Tax is essentially forced spending. The government knows that you would not be willing to spend your money the way it wants you to spend it, so they take your money and spend it for you. That's what tax is. Secondly, disliking how your money is put to work is the flip side of the same coin offered by those who say that they don't mind paying tax if they know it's put to good use. The truth is that willingness to pay is never an issue in taxation. You're forced to pay whether you're willing to or not. The idea of withholding your payment of tax in some kind of self-made escrow until government policy comes around to your way of thinking is to miss the point entirely. What we also find in today's society is that there is indeed a great amount of work to be done, but no one to do it. Yet there'll be high unemployment. This creates a perfect storm for off-the-books work. Unemployment is here to stay. In Sweden, unemployment is 7%, which is lower than most European countries, but it is a chronic level. Even when times are good in the rest of the continent, unemployment has been a steady 7% for about as long as I can remember. So even at a practical level, the most compelling reason to engage in a line of work that might qualify as being on the black market is simply to make a living in an environment that has little to offer in the way of conventional employment. What someone new to the black market must do, however, is change his mindset. In urban settings, we confuse the process of working for work. Many of us have jobs that involve pushing buttons or creating pieces of paper for about 8 hours a day, and then going home without seeing the ultimate results. An underground worker will be doing jobs in which only the final result counts, and payment is not received until then. There's no overtime, there's no comp time. Those who live in small towns have a distinct advantage over those in the cities, especially those in university towns filled with socialist, psycho-intellectual yammerheads. Although even then, there's room for the black market laborer. Generally, attitudes are more individualistic in small towns and people are more receptive. People will be willing to buy if you have something to sell, and unless you rub someone the wrong way or happen to encounter a bootlicking fink, you're very unlikely to get into trouble. Flea markets are great covers for black market sales, as they are hidden in plain sight, as it were. About 10 years ago, I wanted to earn some extra money to buy Christmas presents, so I sold gingerbread cookies at a flea market in Gothenburg. For 2 weekends of work, I earned the equivalent of about $1,000. Only one customer ever asked me for a receipt, which I did give to her with my correct personal ID number. The receipt was for less than $4, and as gingerbread cookies are not deductible items, it's unlikely the tax office ever saw that receipt. One line of work that Ragnar Bentzen recommends in his book is that of collecting and cutting firewood. Of all the examples he gave in his book, this was the one that I found most believably to have potential as a sustainable business. Essentially, a man with a pickup truck and a chainsaw could be in the business of tree removal and then sell those trees as firewood. Trees can also be found at roadsides. In Sweden, it's legal to cut down dead standing wood from forests that are not on private property. And private forest owners usually grant salvage rights to individuals to take tree stumps left over after a commercial felling operation. Trees may be cut several feet above the ground, leaving quite a bit of firewood behind for any industrious salvager. Bentzen reckons that a serious firewood gathering and collecting operation of this kind will likely yield $10,000 per year for about 40 days of steady hard work. Advertising is easy. Posters can be put up in grocery stores, ads can be placed in local papers, and of course, one can drive around and easily spot those homes that have fireplaces. So go knock on the door or leave a flyer. Now, Bentzen goes on to mention things like produce stands, tapping maple trees for sap, cultivating ginseng, collecting pine cones for nurseries, picking wild mushrooms. These all seem to be worth a try, and on the surface they can be claimed to be merely hobbies, in case Big Brother starts poking around. However, I'm not sure how many of them would really allow you to make a living. The firewood business, yes, sure, but perhaps some of these other things should be relied on only as homesteading measures for your own consumption, and perhaps occasional sales, which as a legitimate hobby would not be taxable anyway. In urban settings, there are jobs that are notorious for being off the books. These include house cleaning, house repairs, hauling and removals of all sorts, yard work, window washing, pet care, house sitting. There are even skilled trades in which off-the-books work is viable, such as photography and carpentry. The labor unions will not like this, but solidarity will not put food on the table. Cash will. Roofing and welding are also tasks often done for cash. Think of the kinds of professions that would be needed even in the worst economic situations. Likely not writers or ballet dancers. However, that does not rule out all forms of entertainment. Of course, there's always a risk in doing something illegal, and one needs to weigh the pros and the cons. And indeed, I'm not suggesting that you break the law, but I will point out that those who do break the law in this way are not especially likely to get into serious trouble unless the state wants to make an example of them, or if they run afoul of the labor unions. As long as you pay sales tax and do not cost the state any money, it's unlikely you'll have any serious troubles. But whatever you do, don't fight taxation on a moral, legal grounds openly. You're in the right, but you might as well be arguing with a hold-up man.
I'm not afraid to die.
You're listening to VSI Radio International. To contact the program and to offer any comments or questions, please send an email to feedback@vsiradio.org. That's feedback@victorsierraindiaradio.org. VSI Radio International is produced in Sweden, exclusively for broadcast on WBCQ, transmitting from Monticello, Maine, USA on 7,490 kHz. My name is Paul Lambert. I would be remiss in not pointing out many of the downsides to being solely in the black market. Without a conventional employer, one must often provide for one's own insurance and retirement savings. Granted, this is also a problem that the self-employed face. Those of you in the United States face the added problem of the rather unhealthy relationship the IRS has with the banks when it comes to reporting, while there is a great deal more privacy in this regard in other countries. Ragnar Benson writes that foreign bank accounts are one answer, but complains that getting them requires skill and is too much trouble for the average undergrounder. Fortunately, Ragnar Benson is, at least in this regard, very much mistaken. I, for instance, have a bank account at Lloyd's, located on the Isle of Man. The bank sent me all the necessary forms. I simply had to send a photocopy of my passport, signed by my local bank manager, and carefully fill in some other information. I was required to make an initial deposit of £100. At present, the monthly fee is £20 if your balance is under £2,500. Above that, there are no fees. The bank issues you a Visa debit card that can be used as a credit card, and the limit is whatever you have on deposit. Being a debit card and not a credit card, you do not have to provide any proof of income. The problems that undergrounders face in not having credit cards, such as not being able to hire cars or to buy airline tickets, are thus overcome, and the banks on the Isle of Man are prohibited from sharing information with foreign governments. The tax burdens faced by businesses of all kinds can be greatly eased with the use of offshore trusts. Now, I'll leave it to you to contact a lawyer or financial professional if you seriously want to consider this possibility, but for now, I'll only tell you not to believe the propaganda that offshore trusts are only available to those who are already very rich and that these are the means by which large corporations get away with tax evasion. Nothing could be further from the truth. I can only suggest that you, with your lawyer, look into these and other legal means of tax mitigations. Use the freedom you still have before deciding the degree to which you want to enter into the black market. Thank you for joining me tonight on VSI Radio International. I hope you found tonight's broadcast informative and enlightening. Please tune in again next week at 7 p.m. for another episode. Until then, this is Paul Lambert wishing you a pleasant week.
If you've enjoyed this presentation, visit www.justrightmedia.org for more programming that's not right-wing, it's just right.